Accession number 10642, Reel 1.
Mr. Beard, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, Mr. Beard?
In West Norwood.
And this was in 1898?
In 1898.
What did your father do for a living?
My father originally was a grocer, became a grocer manager, and then finished up as the publican.
How did you come to be in the Royal Flying Corps?
Well, I had 10 months in the Royal Artillery, which I joined on the 5th of January, 1915. I'd been away with them to Hemel Hempstead. We were back at the depot, and two Royal Flying Corps officers were coming round looking for recruits for the Flying Corps, as they were getting short of ammunition. Two of us got picked out after tests, went to the Duke of York School, Chelsea, for tests. The other fellow failed. I passed. I just had time to come over to West Norwood and tell my mother I'm off to Farnborough tonight. So off to Farnborough I went.
What made you want to join?
Well, in the first place, well, just I'd got a couple of the members of the family in the army, and I thought, well, I might as well. I know I was only 15. Actually, I was 16 when I went in. 16 and 10 days. I have no regrets. I've had wonderful experiences, met some wonderful people.
But why did you want to go into the Flying Corps?
Well, I thought it was something different to the artillery, and I had a fancy for flying. I made my first flight on the 16th of May, 1916. I did my training at the at Uphaven, the Central Flying School. And I was with 19 Squadron, who I joined in December 1915. Well, my squadron then was at Netherhaven, which is near Uphaven. And I went back to my squadron. And then from there we went to Bristol, and I finished my final flying with a Captain Hooper, who was chief test pilot for the British and Colonial Aircraft Factory. And from there we went to France in 1916, August 1916.
So, do you remember the dates that you actually went into the Royal Flying Corps?
Yeah, the actual date was... let me think a bit. December 1915, that's right. 16, yes.
How did you take to flying?
Loved it.
What kind of machine did you go up in, first of all?
The very first one I went in was a BE-2C with a 90 horsepower RAF engine. That is Royal Aircraft Factory, Farnborough. We had them, went overseas with them, and in December 1916, we went on to Spads. Spad is not a word. It's S-P-A-D. And they had a 140 Espana Suiza engine. And then from that, we changed aerodromes and we went to Bayeux. And there we had stopped with camels.
Where's Bayeux?
Bayeux is... it's not far from Dieppe and Pont-Niep, which is Belgium, really.
What did you think to the stop with camel?
It was a difficult plane to fly, but once you conquered it, it was a beauty.
What was so difficult about flying it?
Beg pardon?
What was so difficult about flying it?
Well, it's like some people. It had a will of its own. But once you overcome that and mastered it, it's like a bad child. Once you mastered the bad child, you got control of it.
Did you have any affection for it as a machine?
I liked it. It's a real beauty. Real beauty. It is. So was the pup. I never flew a pup.
Were the machines dangerous to fly in those days?
Well, the whole point is, flying in those days was all dangerous. Because you never knew what was going to happen. After all, you must remember that in the Flying Corps days, the actual flying and fighting and that was in its infancy. And you see so many planes coming into land and just make a bad landing. The most reasons for that was a mistake on their elevators, because your landing is controlled by your elevators. And your elevators is controlled by your joystick. That's left to right. That was your ailerons, pardon, left to right. Your elevators, it was backwards and forwards. Your rudder, you had a rudder bar. That's where you could tread it with your feet.
Which particular squadron were you in?
All the time, 19. Spent all my time in 19.
Can you tell me about its makeup?
Yes, originally we had four flights, A, B and C, and headquarter flight. That was the administrative side. And we had 12 planes. Then we went to 6-door flight, so we had 18 planes. We were a reconnaissance bomber squadron. We carried 12 20-pounders, four under each wing, and four under your cockpit. And you could only release those in fours. For something bigger, we had 2 60-pounders, one under each wing. And for a big do, like a railhead, or something like that, ammunition dump, we had a 120-pounder that laid the full length of the fuselage. We also... and I've never come across anybody else that knew, but we used to drop a spy. We had a pigeon loft, and it was a mobile one, and we used to drop him. He was, I estimate him, being young myself, estimated to be in his late 30s, middle to late 30s. And he'd have a basket on his back with six pigeons. And when pigeon number six came back, his messaging code was he was returning, which he had to do under his own steam. or he wanted more pigeons, and we used to drop him a basket with six pigeons in until he got the return. Now, he was carried on the trailing edge of a wing, sitting in the seat with the safety belt out of an old B-2C that had been crashed. And he sat there, all mapped out where he was to be dropped, because it was night flying then, and he was dropped. Now, night flying, for returning to the aerodrome, they were cylinders about a foot high and about 4 to 5 inches in diameter. And they were filled with carbide. And they stood in empty four-gallon cans of petrol with the water in, lit there, and lit two lines of them, and that was for landing. Pilot, Captain Henderson, he was a well-known musical star, T.L. de Hearn, the lazy juggler. And we had Bobby Lorraine, Violet Lorraine's brother. He was a flight commander with us.
This particular spy, whereabouts did you drop him, do you know?
Only on Belgium or French territory. Actually, I never did it. I never had the job. We only ever dropped him once. And when he returned, never saw him anymore, and the pigeon loft was taken away. Whether it was taken to another sector or not, I do not know. But on that same aerodrome, 60 Squadron, there was McCudden. But I didn't know him then. Now, on the left was number 18 Squadron with FEs. They had a nacelle. It was a pusher plane. And flight commander there was Captain Leif Robinson. You know who he was?
Yes.
He brought the Zeppelin down, didn't he? Cuffley. He was flight commander. He was brought down but not injured and was a prisoner until after the war. When he was repatriated, he went down with one of these flu epidemics and died about a year after he'd been back. Now, when I did meet McCudden, because Leif Robinson was a VC, McCudden was with 56 Squadron then. That was down near Swoisens, which is down in the south. And also, he'd been out before. He came out with 56 Squadron. And also who came out for the second time was Captain Ball, another VC.
What was McCudden like?
They were both very likeable guys. Both. Captain Ball never wore a helmet. He had a mop of hair. He was a Yorkshireman. He was the youngest VC in the Royal Flying Corps. And I'll tell you a true story about him. We were given a concert, because we ran a concert party in the squadron, and they were invited down, and he was sitting along there with all the officers of our squadron in the front, and his batman come running down. He said, "Captain, your hut's on fire." They were Nissan huts, canvas and wood. And I'll tell you what he said. He said, "Bugger the hut, I'm enjoying the concert." That's Captain Ball. Now, Captain Ball and McCudden were both killed from that aerodrome flying those SE-5s. They had 240 horsepower, a Spahn-Sweezer engine. But a beautiful plane. Beautiful plane.
Did you like both McCudden and Ball? Did you like both McCudden and Ball?
Yes, I liked them both. Yes. Oh, yes, I liked them both. Especially Captain... McCudden was a real nice guy. But there was something about Captain Ball that was different, which is hard to explain. And also we had with us, and who was lost, was Bransby Williams. Now, Bransby Williams' father was Bransby Williams. He was a character actor, lived at Tulse Hill, just across here. And he got killed with us. And they were all killed by the Baron's circus. As you know, the Baron flew in the centre of his circus. Now, two lieutenants, myself and another one, went up to on the Ypres front to see them operating on the balloons. Never went up in one. And this was number 9 balloon section. To the left of us was number 11. Now, one of the balloonists there was Basil Allam. He was the one who wrote the well-known song Burlington Bertie from Bow. When the Baron's circus attacked, he jumped and Basil's parachute never opened. That was the end of Basil Allam. Straight down and that was it.
You're mentioning Leif Robertson. Can you tell me what he was like as a man?
Well, Leif Robertson, he was a bit on the slim side. Have a lot to him because we all messed in our own individual messes.
What rank did you hold at the time?
Only second lieutenant.
How did a junior officer like yourself get treated by the senior officers?
Oh! There was no difference. One was as good as the other, irrespective of rank. There was all in no way, after all, the OC... The OC of a squadron was a major. We went out with Major Rodwell. He was made into a lieutenant colonel and left us, came back to England. I don't know the end of him. And then we had Major Sandys, the gentleman jockey. He was a little man.
Why was he called the gentleman jockey?
Well, him and his brother were both... steeplechasers, see, amateurs, as you know, in cricketers they call them gentlemen, and players and gentlemen. But of course, he was an unpaid steeplechaser. Two of them, him and his brother. And all the time he was with us, he wore riding breeches, not the usual.
What was your uniform as a pilot? What were you dressed in to go up?
I'll show you in a minute.
Can you describe it in words?
Well, you had a choice of two. You had a short leather jacket with two big patches here and a breast one, open one, that one is. And or you could have the long one. Now, if you had the short one, you had leather trousers with it, which belted at the bottom. And leather boots, fur-lined, fleece-lined, and the sides and that were not smooth leather, rough leather, but the rest were the proper leather. And the soles had a very thick sole of green leather, which was known as dry ped.
Dry ped,
D-R-I-P-E-D, and the name was in a triangle, a diamond rather. Yeah, dry ped. Yes, the sides of the boots were suede. And then, much later on, they changed to the very long fleece-lined boots that's braced up here with great thick rubber soles. But
where did the braces go up to?
Big pardon?
Where were they braced up to?
Over your shoulders. Had a bit on you, put them over your shoulders. But we preferred the old ones. And there's something else. And in the cold weather, because we had open cockpits, and you had a winter warmer.
What was that?
It was a little cylinder with felt round it, filled with a slow-burning, smouldering material, which you kept in your pocket. Now, you had your gauntlets, but your first glove you put on was a pure silk glove. Then you had your leather gauntlet with fingers, and then a button piece back that came over and made it into a muff. If your hand got very cold, you put your hand in your pocket, take your winter warmer out, have a little warm, pass it the other one, have a little warm, and put it back again.
Why did you have the two pairs of gloves?
Well, silk, as you know, silk is the warmest material there is. Pure silk is very, very warm. And, of course, for your controls, although they're warm, they wouldn't be warm enough in an open cockpit in the middle of December. And that's why you had the rubber gauntlets.
Leather gauntlets?
Yes, leather. Yeah, leather gauntlets. I gave mine to my my uncle. I still had them when I come home.
And can you describe the helmets?
Yes. And this is a funny thing. A lot of people, when I show them a photograph I've got of myself, I've got a crash helmet under my arm. Now, that crash helmet had very thick padding round here. And the only place you'll see one is down at the museum at Hendon. And there is one there. I've got a picture of myself with mine under my arm. I'll show it to you in a minute.
And goggles?
Yes, they were a very wide goggle, fur lined, leather, and fur lined. Now, from that crash helmet type, we went to an ordinary soft chamois leather lined pull on helmet that interlaced and tied up on the top. And they were good.
Now, you said that you were stationed at Bayeux.
Bayeux.
Did you stay there the whole time?
No. We were at Bayeux. We went to Popperinge, where Tokaj was formed. And from Popperinge, from Popperinge, we came down to Bayeux. From Bayeux, we went down to near Swoisens. The actual name, I know it's only a short name, but I can never remember it. It began with either S or C, but it was only four. That was the aerodrome that Captain Ball and McCudden were lost from, and Brandenby Williams. We also... Now, they were... Squadron leaders were grounded because they were losing too many squadron leaders, and they were grounded. Well, things got very, very bad.
Do you know when this was?
Beg pardon?
Do you know when this was?
This was right at the end of 1917, beginning of 1918. And at any rate, things were getting so bad that squadron leaders had to go again. And incidentally, we lost him. But I can't remember the name of the one who came to take his place. senior flight commander took over for a time. And when the war ended, I came back to England. Not with the squadron. I came home on leave and then stayed here. And I had to go down to Richmond Park to close a Bloom training depot. Number 2 Bloom training depot. And now, the parachute then was a guardian angel. And the designer of that parachute, his own daughter used to test them from a balloon in Richmond Park. Now, it wasn't a basket, it was a platform. And she used to test the parachutes. I don't know what his name was, but that was the name of the parachute. Guardian angel.
Can we go back to when you were in France?
Yes.
How frightened were you to go up in combat in view of all these losses of your comrades?
Goes out. For some unknown reason, you don't think. It just doesn't enter your head. You're only concerned with what you're in and what's going to happen. You're only thinking entirely of yourself and your observer who was sitting in the front, because in a B2C, the pilot is behind, the observer's in front. The Maxim machine gun, air-cooled, Vickers Maxim, was controlled by the pilot from the back, but the Lewis gun on the top was the observers. Now, there was no such thing as aerial gunners like they had in the last war. Everyone was classified as an observer. He wore the O and the wing. And he had the Lewis gun.
So, were any of your brother officers worried about going up, or was it just you?
I never knew anybody. All right, when it was got time, all right, you was off on there, everybody was there and up in their planes and that, and away.
Did you look forward to flying?
Yes. Yeah. Wish I could do it still.
Did you have your own personal machine, or could you be allocated to any machine?
Oh, no, it all depends your flight. You just went in and just took one, right.
Did you always have the same observer?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Who was he?
Oh, the faintest idea. Names, so many.